Chapters 1 through 3 Alarms and Discursions by G. K. Chesterton. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 1 Introductory on Gargoyles. Alone at some distance from the wasting halls of a disused abbey, I found half-sunken in the grass the gray and goggle-eyed visage of one of those graven monsters that made the ornamental waterspouts in the cathedrals of the Middle Ages. It lay there, scoured by ancient rains or striped by recent fungus, but still looking like the head of some huge dragon slain by a primeval hero. And as I looked at it, I thought of the meaning of the grotesque, and passed into some symbolic reverie of the three great stages of art. 1. Once upon a time, there lived upon an island a merry and innocent people, mostly shepherds and tillers of the earth. They were republicans, like all primitive and simple souls. They talked over their affairs under a tree, and the nearest approach they had to a personal ruler was a sort of priest or white witch who said their prayers for them. They worshipped the sun, not idolatrously, but as the golden crown of the god, whom all such infants see almost as plainly as the sun. Now this priest was told by his people to build a great tower, pointing to the sky in salutation of the sun god, and he pondered long and heavily before he picked his materials, for he was resolved to use nothing that was not almost as clear and exquisite as sunshine itself. He would use nothing that was not washed as white as the rain can wash the heavens, nothing that did not sparkle as spotlessly as that crown of God. He would have nothing grotesque or obscure. He would not have even anything emphatic or even anything mysterious. He would have all the arches as light as laughter and as candid as logic. He built the temple in three concentric courts, which were cooler and more exquisite in substance each than the other. For the outer wall was a hedge of white lilies, ranked so thick that a green stalk was hardly to be seen, and the wall within that was of crystal, which smashed the sun into a million stars. And the wall within that, which was the tower itself, was a tower of pure water, forced up in an everlasting fountain. And upon the very tip and crest of that foaming spire was one big and blazing diamond, which the water tossed up eternally and caught again as a child catches a ball. "Now," said the priest, "I have made a tower which is a little worthy of the sun." 2. But about this time the island was caught in a swarm of pirates, and the shepherds had to turn themselves into rude warriors and seamen, and at first they were utterly broken down in blood and shame, and the pirates might have taken the jewel flung up for ever from their sacred font. And then, after years of horror and humiliation, they gained a little and began to conquer, because they did not mind defeat. And the pride of the pirates went sick with them after a few unexpected foils, and at last the invasion rolled back into the empty seas, and the island was delivered. And for some reason after this, men began to talk quite differently about the temple and the sun. Some indeed said, "You must not touch the temple. It is classical, it is perfect, since it admits no imperfections." But the others answered, "In that it differs from the sun. That sun that shines on the evil and the good, and on the mud and the monsters everywhere. The temple is of the noon. It is made of white marble clouds and sapphire sky. But the sun is not always of the noon. The sun dies daily. Every night he is crucified in blood and fire." Now the priest had taught and fought through all the war, and his hair had grown white. but his eyes had grown young, and he said, "I was wrong, and they are right. The sun, the symbol of our father, gives life to all those earthly things that are full of ugliness and energy. All the exaggerations are right, if they exaggerate the right thing. Let us point to heaven with tusks and horns and fins and trunks and tails, so long as they all point to heaven. The ugly animals praise God as much as the beautiful. The frog's eyes stand out of his head because he is staring at heaven. The giraffe's neck is long because he is stretching towards heaven. The donkey has ears to hear. Let him hear." And under the new inspiration they planned a gorgeous cathedral in the Gothic manner, with all the animals of the earth crawling over it, and all the possible ugly things making up one common beauty, because they all appealed to the god. The columns of the temple were carved like the necks of giraffes, the dome was like an ugly tortoise, and the highest pinnacle was a monkey standing on his head with his tail pointing at the sun. And yet the whole was beautiful, because it was lifted up in one living and religious gesture, as a man lifts his hands in prayer. 3. But this great plan was never properly completed. The people had brought up on great wagons the heavy tortoise roof and the huge necks of stone, and all the thousand and one oddities that made up that unity, the owls and the elves and the crocodiles and the kangaroos, which hideous by themselves might have been magnificent if reared in one definite proportion and dedicated to the sun. For this was Gothic, this was romantic, this was Christian art. This was the whole advance of Shakespeare upon Sophocles. And that symbol which was to crown it all, the ape upside down, was really Christian, for man is the ape upside down. But the rich, who had grown riotous in the long peace, obstructed the thing, and in some squabble a stone struck the priest on the head, and he lost his memory. He saw piled in front of him frogs and elephants, monkeys and giraffes, toadstools and sharks, all the ugly things of the universe which he had collected to do honor to God. But he forgot why he had collected them. He could not remember the design or the object. He piled them all wildly into one heap 50 feet high, and when we had done it all, the rich and influential went into a passion of applause and cried, "This is real art. This is realism. This is things as they really are." That, I fancy, is the only true origin of realism. Realism is simply romanticism that has lost its reason. This is so, not merely in the sense of insanity, but of suicide. It has lost its reason, that is, its reason for existing. The old Greeks summoned godlike things to worship their god. The medieval Christians summoned all things to worship theirs. Dwarfs and pelicans, monkeys and madmen. The modern realists summon all these million creatures to worship their god and then have no god for them to worship. Paganism was in art a pure beauty. That was the dawn. Christianity was a beauty created by controlling a million monsters of ugliness, and that, in my belief, was the zenith and the noon. Modern art and science practically mean having the million monsters and being unable to control them, and I will venture to call that the disruption and the decay. The finest lengths of the Elgin marbles consist splendid houses going to the temple of a virgin. Christianity, with its gargoyles and grotesques, really amounted to saying this, that a donkey could go before all the horses of the world when it was really going to the temple. Romance means a holy donkey going to the temple. Realism means a lost donkey going nowhere. The fragments of feudal journalism or fleeting impression which are here collected are very like the wrecks and riven blocks that were piled in a heap around my imaginary priest of the sun. They are very like that gray and gaping head of stone that I found overgrown with the grass. Yet I will venture to make even of these trivial fragments the high boast that I am a mediævalist and not a modern. That is, I really have a notion of why I have collected all the nonsensical things there are. I have not the patience, nor perhaps the constructive intelligence, to state the connecting link between all these chaotic papers. But it could be stated. This row of shapeless and ungainly monsters which I now set before the reader does not consist of separate idols cut out capriciously in lonely valleys or various islands. These monsters are meant for the gargoyles of a definite cathedral. I have to carve the gargoyles because I can carve nothing else. I leave to others the angels and the arches and the spires, but I am very sure of the style of the architecture and of the consecration of the church. Chapter 2. The Surrender of a Cockney. Every man, though he were born in the belfry of Bow and spent his infancy climbing among chimneys, has waiting for him somewhere a country house which he has never seen, but which was built for him in the very shape of his soul. It stands patiently waiting to be found knee-deep in orchards of Kent or mirrored in pools of Lincoln, and when the man sees it, he remembers it, though he has never seen it before. Even I have been forced to confess this at last, who am a Cockney, if ever there was one. A Cockney not only in principle, but with savage pride. I have always maintained quite seriously that the Lord is not in the wind or the thunder of the waste, but if anywhere in the still small voice of Fleet Street. I sincerely maintain that nature worship is more morally dangerous than the most vulgar man worship of the cities, since it can easily be perverted into the worship of an impersonal mystery, carelessness, or cruelty. Thoreau would have been a jollier fellow if he had devoted himself to a greengrocer instead of to greens. Swinburne would have been a better moralist if he had worshipped the fishmonger instead of worshipping the sea. I prefer the philosophy of bricks and mortar to the philosophy of turnips. To call a man a turnip may be playful, but it is seldom respectful. But when we wish to pay emphatic honor to a man, to praise the firmness of his nature, the squareness of his conduct, the strong humility with which he is interlocked with his equals in silent mutual support, then we invoke the nobler Cockney metaphor and call him a brick. But despite all these theories, I have surrendered. I have struck my colors at sight, at a mere glimpse through the opening of a hedge. I shall come down to living in the country like any common socialist or simpler lifer. I shall end my days in a village, in the character of the village idiot, and be a spectacle and a judgment to mankind. I have already learnt the rustic manner of leaning upon a gate, and I was thus gymnastically occupied at the moment when my eye caught the house that was made for me. It stood well back from the road and was built of good yellow brick. It was narrow for its height, like the tower of some border robber, and over the front door was carved in large letters, 1908. That last burst of sincerity, that superb scorn of antiquarian sentiment, overwhelmed me finally. I closed my eyes in a kind of ecstasy. My friend, who was helping me lean on the gate, asked me with some curiosity what I was doing. "My dear fellow," I said with emotion, "I am bidding farewell to 43 handsome cabsmen." "Well," he said, "I suppose they would think this country rather outside the radius." "Oh, my friend," I cried brokenly, "how beautiful London is. Why do they only write poetry about the country? I could turn every lyric cry into Cockney. My heart leaps up when I behold the A sky sign in the sky." As I observed in a volume which is too little read, founded on the older English poets, "You never saw my golden treasury regilded, or the classics made Cockney. It contains some fine lines. O wild West End, thou breath of London's being, or the reminiscences of Keats' beginning, city of smuts and mellow fogfulness." I have written many such lines on the beauty of London, yet I never realized that London was really beautiful till now. Do you ask me why? It is because I have left it forever. "If you will take my advice," said my friend, "you will humbly endeavour not to be a fool. What is the sense of this mad modern notion that every literary man must live in the country with pigs and the donkeys and the squires? Chaucer and Spenser and Milton and Dryden lived in London. Shakespeare and Dr. Johnson came to London because they had quite enough of the country. And as for trumpery, topical journalists like you, why, they would cut their throats in the country. You have confessed it yourself in your own last words. You hunger and thirst after the streets. You think London the finest place on the planet. And if by some miracle a Bayswater omnibus could come down this green country lane, you would utter a yell of joy." Then a light burst upon my brain, and I turned upon him with terrible sternness. "Why, miserable aesthete," I said in a voice of thunder, "that is the true country spirit. That is how the real rustic feels. The real rustic does utter a yell of joy at the sight of Bayswater omnibus. The real rustic does think London the finest place on the planet. In the few moments that I have stood by this stile, I have grown rooted here like an ancient tree. I have been here for ages. Petulant suburban, I am the real rustic. I believe that the streets of London are paved with gold, and I mean to see it before I die." The evening breeze freshened among the little tossing trees of that lane, and the purple evening clouds piled up and darkened behind my country seat, the house that belonged to me, making, by contrast, its yellow bricks gleam like gold. At last my friend said, "To cut it short, then, you mean that you will live in the country because you won't like it? What on earth will you do here? Dig up the garden?" "Dig," I answered in honorable scorn, "dig, do work at my country seat. No, thank you. When I find a country seat, I sit in it. And for your other objections, you are quite wrong. I do not dislike the country, but I like the town more. Therefore, the art of happiness certainly suggests that I should live in the country and think about the town. Modern nature worship is all upside down. Trees and fields ought to be the ordinary things. Terraces and temples ought to be extraordinary. I am on the side of the man who lives in the country and wants to go to London. I abominate and abjure the man who lives in London and wants to go to the country. I do it with all the more heartiness because I am that sort of man myself. We must learn to love London again as a rustic loves it. Therefore," I quote again from the great Cockney version of the Golden Treasury, "therefore, ye gas pipes, ye asbestos stoves, forbid not any severing of our loves. I have relinquished but your earthly sight to hold you dear in a more distant way. I'll love the buses lumbering through the wet even more than when I lightly tripped as they. The grimy color of the London clay is lovely yet, because I have found the house where I was really born, the tall and quiet house from which I can see London afar off as the miracle of man that it is." The Nightmare. A sunset of copper and gold has just broken down and gone to pieces in the west, and gray colors were crawling over everything in earth and heaven. Also a wind was growing, a wind that laid cold finger upon the flesh and spirit. The bushes at the back of my garden began to whisper like conspirators, and then to wave like wild hands in signal. I was trying to read by the last light that died on the lawn a long poem of the decadent period, a poem about the old gods of Babylon and Egypt, about their blazing and obscene temples, their cruel and colossal faces. "O, didst thou love the god of flies who plagued the Hebrews and was splashed with wine unto the waist, or Pasht, who had green barrels for her eyes?" I read this poem because I had to review it for the Daily News. Still, it was genuine poetry of its kind. It really gave out an atmosphere, a fragrant and suffocating smoke that seemed really to come from the bondage of Egypt or the burden of Tyre. There is not much in common, thank God, between my garden with the gray-green English sky beyond it and these mad visions of painted palaces, huge headless idols and monstrous solitudes of red or golden sand. Nevertheless, as I confess to myself, I can fancy in such stormy twilight some such smell of death and fear. The ruined sunset really looks like one of the ruined temples, a shattered heap of gold and green marble. A black flapping thing detaches itself from one of the sombre trees and flutters to another. I know not if it is owl or flittermouse. I could fancy it was a black cherub, an infernal cherub of darkness, not with the wings of a bird and the head of a baby, but with the head of a goblin and the wings of a bat. I think if there were light enough, I could sit here and write some very creditable, creepy tale about how I went up the crooked road beyond the church and met something. Say a dog with one eye. Then I should meet a horse, perhaps a horse without a rider. The horse also would have one eye. Then the inhuman silence would be broken. I should meet a man. Need I say a one-eyed man? Who would ask me the way to my own house, or perhaps tell me that it was burnt to the ground. I could tell a very cozy little tale along some such lines, or I might dream of climbing forever the tall, dark trees above me. They are so tall that I feel as if I should find at their tops the nests of the angels. But in this mood, they would be dark and dreadful angels, angels of death. Only, you see, this mood is all bosh. I do not believe in it in the least. That one-eyed universe with its one-eyed men and beasts was only created with one universal wink. At the top of the tragic trees I should not find the angel's nest. I should only find the mare's nest. The dreamy and divine nest is not there. In the mare's nest I shall discover that dim, enormous, opalescent egg from which is hatched the nightmare. For there is nothing so delightful as a nightmare when you know it is a nightmare. That is the essential. That is the stern condition laid upon all artists touching this luxury of fear. The terror must be fundamentally frivolous. Sanity may play with insanity, but insanity must not be allowed to play with sanity. Let such poets as the one I was reading in the garden by all means be free to imagine what outrageous deities and violent landscapes they like. By all means let them wander freely amid their opium pinnacles and their perspectives. But these huge gods, these high cities are toys. They must never for an instant be allowed to be anything else. Man, a gigantic child, must play with Babylon and Nineveh, with Isis and with Ashtaroth. By all means let him dream of the bondage of Egypt, so long as he is free from it. By all means let him take up the burden of Tyre, so long as he can take it lightly. But the old gods must be his dolls, not his idols. His central sanctities, his true possessions, should be Christian and simple. And just as a child would cherish most a wooden horse or a sword that is a mere cross of wood, so man, the great child, must cherish most the old plain things of poetry and piety, that horse of wood that was the epic of Ilium, or that cross of wood that redeemed and conquered the world. In one of Stevenson's letters there is a characteristically humorous remark about the appalling impression produced on him in childhood by the beasts with many eyes in the Book of Revelation. If that was heaven, what in the name of Davy Jones was hell like? Now, in sober truth, there's a magnificent idea in these monsters of the apocalypse. It is, I suppose, the idea that beings really more beautiful or more universal than we are might appear to us frightful and even confused. Especially they might seem to have senses at once more multiplex and more staring, an idea very imaginatively seized in the multitude of eyes. I like those monsters beneath the throne very much, but I like them beneath the throne. It is when one of them goes wandering in deserts and finds a throne for himself that evil faiths begin, and there is literally the devil to pay in dancing girls or human sacrifice. As long as those misshapen elemental powers are around the throne, remember that the thing that they worship is the likeness of the appearance of a man. That is, I fancy, the true doctrine on the subject of tales of terror and such things, which, unless a man of letters do well and truly believe, without doubt he will end by blowing his brains out, or by writing badly. Man, the central pillar of the world, must be upright and straight. Around him all the trees and beasts and elements and devils may crook and curl like smoke if they choose. All really imaginative literature is only the contrast between the weird curves of nature and the straightness of the soul. Man may behold what ugliness he likes, if he is sure that he will not worship it. But there are some so weak that they will worship a thing only because it is ugly. These must be chained to the beautiful. It is not always wrong even to go like Dante to the brink of the lowest promontory and look down at hell. It is when you look up at hell that a serious miscalculation has probably been made. Therefore, I see no wrong in riding with a nightmare tonight. She whinnies to me from the rocking treetops and the roaring wind. I will catch her and ride her through the awful air. Woods and weeds are alike tugging at the roots in the rising tempest, as if all wished to fly with us over the moon, like that wild, amorous cow whose child was the moon calf. We will rise to that mad infinite where there is neither up nor down, the high topsy-turvydom of the heavens. I will answer the call of chaos and old night. I will ride on the nightmare, but she shall not ride on me. End of chapters 1 through 3.